4. From Shapes to Shadows, Dissolving Forms. First, young lady, have you seen Omnibook? It takes 5 or 6 books and boils them down. That way you can read them all in one evening. Second, young lady, I wouldn't like it. Seems to me it would just spoil the movie for you. It is only a short step from exaggerating what we can find in the world to exaggerating our power to remake the world. Expecting more novelty than there is, more greatness than there is, and more strangeness than there is, we imagine ourselves masters of a plastic universe. But a world we can shape to our will, or to our extravagant expectations, is a shapeless world. When Michelangelo, in the traditional story, explained that he carved his statue of David simply by taking away the superfluous marble, he meant that his peculiar vision dwelt somehow in that particular block of stone. Sculptors always, of course, choose a piece of marble because it is well-suited to the figure they have in mind, and they often shape the figure to the marble's flaws. Every artist marries form to matter. He sees his poem in words, his painting in oils on canvas, his statue in stone, his building in some specific material. Art has often been identified with divinity, precisely because the artist gives his work a unique, inimitable embodiment. Like a man, a work of art has a soul, a life all its own. It used to be taken for granted that every work of art possessed a mysterious individuality. A picture could not be made into a poem, a play was not to be found in a novel. Until recently, there were surprisingly few dramatizations of novels. Abridgment was an art not much practiced in literature. Of course, there were legends and folk tales which were transformed by different minstrels or different generations, and so were variously embodied. But the great work of art was that which had the power somehow to remain uniquely itself and itself alone. The original had a priceless and ineffable uniqueness. Men spent fortunes and risked lives to possess the Elgin marbles or a Mona Lisa, to save a particular painting by Domenico Veneziano, or to secure a treasure by Benvenuto Cellini. Approximation was never enough. Every work of art had the fixity, the precise boundaries, which until recently were attributed to God's work in the creation. The idea of fixity of species, which possessed the minds of European and American men until the mid-19th century, was a way of extending to all creation the simple notion that the world was not infinitely malleable. God's artistry had made fixed, definite forms, so that, in Lucretius' words, where each thing can grow and abide is fixed and ordained. 1. The democratic revolutions of the 18th and 19th centuries and the graphic revolution of the 19th and 20th centuries have done much to change this. If art and literature were to be made accessible to all, they had to be made intelligible and inoffensive to all. Popularity was then often bought at the cost of the integrity of the individual work. With the rise of liberalism came the rise of vernacular languages and literatures. Now, the common people could read great works in their own marketplace English, French, German, Spanish, or Italian, instead of having to know the learned languages of Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, in which classical authors had written. Popular government, bringing with it universal literacy and education for everybody, brought also the popularizing of works of art and literature. The age of the rising middle class in Victorian England was, of course, the age of the fig leaf. The fig leaves of decent reticence, which Charles Kingsley described, were applied not only to statuary, but to literature as well. In order to make works of art a national resource available to all, so that anybody of either sex could, without embarrassment, be taken on an edifying, conducted tour of the greatness of the past, The works of art themselves were garbled, emended, watered down, and taken out of context, all in order to make them bland and digestible to uncultivated palates. The age of education thus ironically became the age of expurgation. The new expurgation, unlike the old, of the days of the licensing of printed matter, aimed less to expunge offensive doctrine than to hide offensive facts of life. All this had its effect on literature. Charles and Mary Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare, 1807, were designed to make the bard familiar to the young. Thomas Bowdler, 1754-1825, from whose name we derive the word bowdlerize, meaning to expurgate by removing offensive passages, in 1818 published his 10-volume Family Shakespeare, in which nothing is added to the original text, but those words and expressions are omitted which cannot with propriety be read aloud in a family. It went through 4 editions in 6 years, and numerous others thereafter. Encouraged by his success, he prepared a similar 6-volume edition of Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. For the use of families and young persons, reprinted from the original text, with the careful omissions of all passages of an irreligious or immoral tendency. What the new public museums were to works of art, the new popularizations were to works of literature. The precious literary objects, once enjoyed almost exclusively by the aristocrats of birth, wealth, or learning, were now to be put on display for the millions. Some, of course, went into tolerably accurate cheap editions. But while sculpture, painting, tapestries, and objets d'art were taken out of context by being removed from monastery and palace to the public museums, much of the best literature was taken out of context by being abridged, expurgated, simplified, and popularized. How to make the esoteric, difficult, lengthy, archaic, and subtle classics of an aristocratic society interesting and edifying, the 18th century phrase was amusing and instructive, for everyone. In England and elsewhere, the age of the Protestant Reformation, the seed time of modern liberalism, was of course an age of translations. For example, Sir John North's Plutarch, 1579, John Florio's Montaigne, 1603, and above all, the great King James Version of the Bible, 1611. In the United States in the 19th century, popular education and popularization tended to become synonymous. A stigma, the odium of an outdated priestly aristocracy, was put on anything that could not be made universally intelligible. Equalitarian America attached a new, disproportionate importance to the knowledge which all could get and to techniques which all could master. In England, for example, rules of spelling had been slow to develop. Shakespeare himself had been illiterate by the standards of the American schoolmarm. But in the United States, where the people were desperately in search of a cultural standard that any able-bodied citizen could meet with reasonable effort and modest opportunities, the spelling fetish established itself quite rapidly. Noah Webster's American Spelling Book, 1789, and his American Dictionary of the English Language, 1828, sold by the millions. Americans were inclined to overvalue whatever could be made intelligible to all, the work of the journalist, Benjamin Franklin, or of the popular humorist, Mark Twain. Popularity became confused with universality. If the Bible was truly an inspired great book, it must have something to say to everyone. By a quaint reversal, it then became axiomatic that anyone could understand the Bible. In the 20th century, our highest praise is to call the Bible the world's bestseller. And it has come to be more and more difficult to say whether we think it is a bestseller because it is great or vice versa. The graphic revolution accentuated all these tendencies. It brought new forces toward popularizing, toward reshaping, and toward disembodying works of art. This it did in several ways. First came the cheapening of printed matter. In the United States, until about 1830, books were sturdily made but expensive to manufacture. The cheap book came in the 1840s. It had been made possible by the new paper-making machines and cylinder presses, which could turn out large quantities at low cost. What historians of the subject call the Great Revolution in Publishing had arrived when, in 1841, two New York weeklies, the New World and Brother Jonathan, entered into cutthroat competition. These weeklies, printed like newspapers to secure a cheap postal rate, were actually devoted to printing serialized novels which had been pirated from England or written by Americans. When readers objected that they could elsewhere buy some of these novels complete before the serials were finished, the competing weeklies began to issue supplements and extras. Each of these was a whole novel, printed on newspaper presses and commonly unbound. Competition became intense and prices came down. In 1842, Bulwer's Zanoni, issued almost simultaneously by the two weeklies, and also by the more reputable Harper's, could be bought for as little as 6 cents a copy. This intense competition did not last. In April 1843, the United States Post Office ruled that supplements had to be mailed under book rates. Then these weeklies, and with them the appeal of shoddy books, declined. The rise of copyrights laws and the gradual enforcement of international copyright regulations, not generally effective till the Berne Convention of 1886, later made pirating difficult and reduced the supply of widely saleable royalty-free books. But never again was the American book trade quite the same. Cheap books were here to stay. Well before the Civil War, book publishing and book selling in the United States had become a highly profitable, highly organized business, offering its wares through retail bookshops, subscription agents, peddlers, and auctioneers. One of the most famous of the early subscription salesmen was Parson Mason Weems. An author as well as a salesman, he wrote the best-selling Life of George Washington, in which appears the earliest version of the story of the cherry tree. By the time Weems died in 1825, he had sold for Caleb P. Wayne, a Philadelphia publisher, nearly 4,000 sets of Marshall's five-volume Life of Washington, and had collected for him on that book alone the sum of $40,000. Apart from improvements in papermaking and printing, the industrialization of bookbinding was perhaps the most important step in the democratization of the book in America. The crucial change was the departure from the old hand-binding method, by which each book and its own binding were made together. By the new casing-in method, the printed sheets were sewn in one operation and then attached to a standard binding that had been made separately. This method came into the United States about 1832. Another important innovation was the introduction of cloth for binding. Vellum, calf, or paper-covered cardboard had been the common materials before. Machines were then developed for pressing the pages together, for stamping design and lettering on bookbinding cloth, for folding paper, for sewing the pages, and finally, an ingenious American invention of the 1890s, for making the case of the book by machine and for putting the sheets into the case. All this, of course, brought down the price of hardbound books. Mark Twain's Innocents Abroad, 1869, for some time after publication, was being sold by subscription agents to about 4,000 purchasers a month. When Shakespeare had been available only in expensive leather-bound folios for noble mansions, there was, of course, little pressure to abridge, bowdlerize, or popularize. But as rising literacy created a demand for cheaper books, the industrialization of bookmaking was an incentive to wider sales. A significant but seldom noticed change has taken place in the United States in the subscription sale of books by book agents who come to the door and sell sets on the installment plan during the 20th century. Subscription books of this kind have always had at least as much the character of home furnishings as of reading matter. Before about 1900, the staples of these salesmen were complete sets of authors like Shakespeare, Dickens, Bulwer Lytton, and Thackeray. Since then, the staples have come to be the multi-volumed encyclopedias, the Britannica, Americana, Childcraft, World Book, Book of Knowledge, Collier's International, for example, which give you the gist of anything you want, including the writings of Shakespeare, Dickens, Bulwer Lytton, and Thackeray. One large seller has been a 20-volume encyclopedia of book digests. Copious photographs and illustrations, many in full color, are the most advertised and perhaps the most used features of these works. Cheap deluxe editions, both of books and of magazines, also have had spectacular success. The Limited Editions Club, organized by subscription in 1929, limited its editions to 1,500 in order to give its members only books printed direct from type and from the original illustration plates. The success of the venture led its director, George Macy, to found the Heritage Press for a larger audience. This produced the novel phenomenon of books supposed to have most of the typographical virtues of limited editions, but now in almost unlimited numbers. Many imitators have produced books which purport to offer the handcrafted beauties of small editions at bargain prices to a mass market. The same newer and cheaper techniques of printing and bookmaking, which widened the audience, also varied the forms in which literature reached the public. A comparable change took place in the graphic arts, and especially in the fine arts of painting and sculpture. Well before the middle of the 20th century, an American could buy for a few dollars a full-color copy of the Mona Lisa or of Van Gogh's Sunflowers, which, properly framed and viewed at a decent distance, was hardly distinguishable from its original. This was a new development. A few connoisseurs looked down their noses at these vulgar misrepresentations of a unique original. Was the old-fashioned traveler in the world of art now to be made into a mere tourist? Was he to be seduced into being satisfied with quick looks at handy copies, which, at best, would be no more than a bicycle ride through the Louvre? The new techniques provided means for popularizing the original and transforming its general idea into a thousand forms, in cheap books, on lampshades, serving platters, and pencil boxes. The first reproduction of a photograph in a newspaper appeared as recently as March 4, 1880, when a picture entitled Shantytown was printed in the New York Daily Graphic. This was made by a new process and was called a halftone. An object is photographed through a fine screen, and then the shadings are represented in print by the dots on the photographic plate. The technique, still in use, was developed by Stephen Horgan and Frederick Eugene Ives. Horgan had tried without success to persuade James Gordon Bennett to use it in the New York Herald. He finally managed to introduce it in the New York Tribune, where the first halftones were printed on power presses in 1897. Improvements in color printing made possible the colored comic strip. Now the yellow press could appear in a full range of colors. In the fall of 1896, Hearst issued a comic supplement, all in color, which he advertised with characteristic reticence as 8 pages of iridescent polychromous effulgence that makes the rainbow look like a lead pipe. The new collotype presses, first imported to this country from Germany in 1890, soon made possible nuances of color reproduction for fine medical and art books. Henry Watson Kent, who had lately been with the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, joined Max Jaffe's pioneer color printing establishment in Vienna in 1926. There, high-grade art reproductions were made for the museum, for other institutions, and for book publishers. Jaffe's son Arthur established his own presses in New York in 1938. Since then, the quality of cheap color reproductions has been much improved. This has been reflected in book and magazine illustration and in the admirable color prints of great paintings now to be found in private homes, hotel rooms, and restaurants throughout the country. Similar improvements have still more recently appeared in the processes of casting and in the making of metallic and plastic reproductions of sculpture. At the reception desks of museums, in gift shops, and in bookstores, it is now possible to purchase cheap reproductions of classic pieces of Egyptian, Greek, or Roman sculpture, which only an expert can distinguish from the originals. The graphic revolution, in one area after another, has provided us with mass-produced originals. Inevitably, then, we come to think that the original is to be distinguished from its technically precise and often more durable copy only by its price. Respect for the original comes close to pure snobbery. What is more natural in a democratic age than that we should begin to measure the stature of a work of art, especially of a painting, by how widely and how well it is reproduced? Van Gogh's sunflowers, which challenged the techniques of color reproduction and which could be tolerably and brightly reproduced at low cost, began to overshadow the drabber classics of the Italian Renaissance. As never before in art, it has become easy for the great, the famous, and the cliché to be synonymous. The original then somehow loses its originality. The copy is far more familiar. Indeed, it is only the copy which is really popular. It often gives us more pleasure. At the Gauguin show at the Chicago Art Institute in 1959, visitors complained that the original paintings were less brilliant than the familiar reproductions. The original itself acquires a technical, esoteric status. It becomes nothing more than a kind of prototype, like the typecastings for our books, or the dyes from which other mass-produced items are made. We begin to wonder whether the primary purpose of a great work of art may not be to provide an original matrix from which copies can be produced. From our point of view, it is more and more the copy, and not the original, which seems to fulfill the artist's true democratic, humanitarian, life-enriching purpose. It is the Van Gogh sunflowers that hung in our college room, and not that which hangs in the museum, that is full of meaning for us. In the world of dramatic arts, the graphic revolution has produced a still subtler and more widespread confusion of forms. The English novel, we must remember, did not arrive as a popular literary form until the 18th century. English drama was, of course, much older, reaching back to the medieval mystery and morality plays, and coming to a climax with Shakespeare and other Elizabethan dramatists. For a number of reasons, however, the two forms, the novel and the play, long remained quite distinct in English literature. It was not usual for a successful novel to be put into dramatic form, much less for a play to be cast into a novel. The obvious limitations of the stage had something to do with this. The sweep of landscape and the panoramas of violent action seen in the pages of novels could not be convincingly transferred to the stage. How could you make sets for war and peace? With the rise of motion pictures, however, these limits were almost destroyed. The new technique made it possible to change scenery in the flash of an eye, to bring vast landscapes and wild action into the theater, now on the screen. The new possibilities of the movie camera, especially in the early days before sound, tempted movie makers to exploit the peculiar capacity of the movie screen to depict what could not have been physically represented on the stage. The first great box office success, still a record holder, was D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, 1915. Which attracted millions by its expansive battle scenes, its torrential action, and its close-ups of the faces of leering villains and of dead soldiers. This was the first movie ever shown in the White House. After seeing it, President Wilson is said to have remarked, "It is like writing history with lightning." The man-made lightning was important not only because it had created a new dramatic form. Equally significant, if less noted, was the simple fact that scenes which before could be vividly depicted only in the pages of a book, but not on the stage, now for the first time could appear in another form, on the movie screen. This new, apparent interchangeableness of dramatic forms was seductive. Before long it helped produce a new amorphousness and elusiveness of all literary dramatic form. From the point of view of the individual's experience, too, this was epoch-making. It made the world of literary forms blurry as it had never been before. Now, for the first time, you could dramatize almost any scene from any novel. The grander the expanses of scenery, the more violent and wide-sweeping the action, the more rapid the changes of scene. In other words, the more ill-suited any drama was to the narrowly confining stage, with its real men and women and its real stage sets physically present in the theater, the more appealing was the story for movie purposes. It was now only a rare novel, which depended on unique and intricate literary devices, that could not be made into a movie. Often the movie was more widely appealing, as it was, of course, more visually vivid than its literary original. There were few plays, and after the addition of sound, signalized by Al Jolson's Jazz Singer in 1927, few musicals, which could not better attract the public from the screen. One consequence of the movie form was to make it possible, or even common, for a spectator to arrive in the middle of one performance and then to see the beginning afterwards. The fragmentation of experience was increased by the invention of television, when a viewer could turn a knob at will and enter programs one after another free of charge, seeing only a piece of each. The distracting possibilities of television reached a climax when, during a much-publicized quarrel between Jack Parr and Ed Sullivan, DeForest Television advertised in the Chicago Sun-Times on March 12, 1961, sets with two or three screens in the same cabinet. The great networks are sharpening their weapons, competitive performances at the same hour. You simply can't jump all around the dial and take a small bite. There's too much to miss. But DeForest double or triple screen TV lets you see all the time. When you like what you see better on one, you touch your remote button and switch sound only, or flick the super magic infrared remote for channel changing, headphones for the stubborn. It's more fun than you dreamed about. Try it tonight. Enjoy it up to 1 year if you like, without paying anything. The increasing technical possibilities of movies and television did have the effect of leaving the novel with an entirely new role. It was now a kind of residuary legatee of radio, of movies, of television. Some of the ablest literary artists, like James Joyce, William Faulkner, and Henry Miller, more and more now explored the inner world, the world of eroticism, obscenity, blasphemy, symbolism, stream of consciousness and introspection, which could not be acceptably displayed on the movie screen. The novelist, then, has been encouraged to explore the boundless non-visual world, as the movie maker has taken over much of his former jurisdiction over the fantasy world of sight, sound, and action. A clue to the new interchangeability of dramatic forms appeared in America in the emergence of a new meaning for the phrase legitimate theater. In England, the word legitimate had long been used in this phrase to distinguish the body of plays, Shakespearean and other, which had a recognized theatrical and literary merit, as contrasted, for example, with light musical entertainment, farce, and melodrama. In the United States, after the rise of movies, legitimate theater expressed a distinction not of quality but of technology. Legitimate theater here came to mean any drama, including musicals, farces, and melodramas, performed by live actors on a stage, as opposed to performances in movies on radio or television. Before I explore these subtler influences of the graphic revolution on our expectations and our experience, I will begin by recalling one of the most elementary and widespread symptoms of dissolving literary forms. This is the rise and popularization of the abridgment and the digest. 2. In earlier times in Europe, the abridgment or digest was a highly specialized literary form. It was used for technical, usually legal, materials. The most famous was the Digests, 533 AD, of the Byzantine Roman Emperor Justinian, who selected the writings of earlier Roman jurists and so preserved Roman law for future ages. English lawyers in the 18th and 19th centuries made comparable digests of the common law. The pioneer American work was Nathan Dane's General Abridgment and Digest of American Law, 8 volumes, 1823. It has been followed by still more elaborate abridgments and digests. Prosperous American law publishers, for example, the West Publishing Company of St. Paul, Minnesota, have made big business out of reducing to accessible form our ever-multiplying statutes and judicial precedents. In the past, it was usually for the student of some special subject matter, needing for professional reasons to be informed about essential points in a vast literature, that publishers prepared abridgments or digests. The general reader, whether reading for pleasure or for instruction, selected his book for its total character and content. He chose a novel, his Cooper, Dickens, or Thackeray, because he liked what the author put in, what he left out, and how he told the story. In a work of nonfiction, in Gerard Sparks, George Bancroft, Francis Parkman, Ralph Waldo Emerson, William Hickling Prescott, he liked what the author told him, and he was attracted by the author's peculiar way of expanding, compressing, and discoursing. Since the later 19th century, much of this has changed. The popular abridgment is the great symptom of the change. With the spread of literacy and the cheapening of books since the graphic revolution, the printed matter available to the citizen has multiplied. The same technological advances which account for modern journalism and for the flood of political pseudo-events also account for the flood of magazines and books. The rising American standard of living has enabled more people to buy them, at the same time that improvements in papermaking and printing have made them cheaper to buy. The diffusion of secondary and higher education has made more people want to buy printed matter. Improvements in merchandising have made books and magazines handier. Advertising has supported more and more magazines. Democratic faith in an informed, participating citizenry has persuaded people they ought to read more and more. The intimate impact of world events, the ever-present threats of depression and war, the spectacular pace of scientific advance, all these remind the citizen of more things he should know about. Magazines themselves, trading on the duty to be informed, prick the citizen's conscience. He must be up on the latest book, conversational about the most recently notorious magazine article, informed about the world in which he lives. James Bryant Conant, former president of Harvard, said in October 1960 that the minimum goal in reading skill for almost all pupils at the end of grade 9 is that these future voters should be able to read with comprehension the front page of a newspaper at the rate of about 200 words a minute. Everybody must know more and more about more and more. How to do it. Today, therefore, everybody feels the need for abridgment, for digests and summaries of the world's culture, the world's opinions, and the world's happenings. Not merely the specialist, the lawyer, or the doctor, but the common citizen needs help. In 20th century America, a literate, prosperous, earnest democracy, the digest has become the citizen's tool. Digests have taken many different forms. One of the earliest and most straightforward was the Literary Digest, 1890 to 1938. Its first issue in March 1890 abridged notable articles from leading magazines, summarized stories and editorials from newspapers, offered book digests, an index of current literature, and a chronicle of current events. The emphasis was emphatically highbrow. The opening sections were entitled Sociological, Industrial, and Political. The lead article in Volume 1, Number 1, by Professor Thomas H. Huxley, On the Natural Inequality of Men, was taken from the issue of an English review, The 19th Century, which had appeared 2 months before. There followed heavy selections from French, German, Italian, and Russian reviews. The articles in the review and press departments, the editors explained, are condensations or summaries of the original articles or of salient points in those articles. In no case do they represent the personal opinions of the editors of the Literary Digest, whose constant endeavor is to present the thought of the author from his own standpoint. The Review of Reviews, begun in England in the same year, within a few months was being separately edited and published in America. It professed a more grandiose purpose. Expressly adapting Matthew Arnold's definition of culture, the editors aimed to make the best thoughts of the best writers in our periodicals universally accessible, to enable the busiest and the poorest in the community to know the best thoughts of the wisest, to follow with intelligent interest the movement of contemporary history. Digests of books and magazines would not long remain so highfalutin. By the early 20th century, the Literary Digest had come down to the level of the newspaper reader. It was then read mostly for its summaries of journalistic reactions to current events, and for its items of popular interest discovered in the less popular magazines. With the founding of the Reader's Digest by DeWitt Wallace in February 1922, a new era of abridgments began. Wallace, son of a Presbyterian preacher professor in a small Midwestern denominational college, proved to be an editorial genius. His digest was soon far more popular than any of the magazines it digested. It became the publishing phenomenon of the 20th century. During the year 1959, for example, when the American Bible Society distributed a total of 17.5 million copies of Scripture, the Reader's Digest was published in some 30 editions, including Braille, and in 13 languages, totaling a world circulation of about 21 million copies a month. In the United States alone, its monthly circulation was then well over 12 million, which was almost twice the circulation of the next most popular American magazine. A reliable survey estimated that the Reader's Digest was read every month by at least 32 million Americans, one of every four adults in the nation. There is no better clue than the rise of the Reader's Digest to the dissolution of forms and to the increasing second-handedness of our experience in 20th century America. This, the most popular magazine in the United States, has offered itself not as an original but as a digest. The shadow outsells the substance. Abridging and digesting is no longer a device to lead the reader to an original which will give him what he really wants. The digest itself is what he wants. The shadow has become the substance. The story of the Reader's Digest is an epic, perhaps we should say a pseudo-epic, of the production of pseudo-events, of the dilution and tautologizing of American experience. Since 1939, when the Digest moved into a specially designed $1.5 million Georgian-style office building, its headquarters have been an 80-acre estate of park and wooded hills outside of Chappaqua, New York, employing about 100 editors and 2,500 clerical workers. It has offices also in New York, London, Paris, Copenhagen, Havana, Helsinki, Quebec, Madrid, Milan, Oslo, Rio de Janeiro, Stockholm, Stuttgart, Sydney, Toronto, and Tokyo. Its writers are constantly traveling the world, but the magazine had modest beginnings. The first issue was prepared in a one-room basement office under a Greenwich Village speakeasy by DeWitt Wallace and his wife, Lila Atchison Wallace, a former English teacher and social worker. They put it together with their own scissors and paste, and carried the mail sacks to the post office. It was an immediate success. The venture could be started on a shoestring precisely because it required no author or editors. Wallace simply went to the New York Public Library and copied out by hand from other magazines his own abridged adapted version of articles he thought would interest readers. The editors of the original magazines considered the circulation of these brief versions to be free advertising. With few exceptions, they gladly allowed Wallace to reprint them without charge. The first issue, setting a pattern which has changed very little, consisted of 62 pages, exclusive of the covers, and offered 31 articles. A legend on the cover of an early issue announced, "An article a day from leading magazines, each article of enduring value and interest in condensed permanent booklet form." True to its factitious character, the Digest represented itself not as a commercial enterprise, but as an association. The issue of August 1923 explained, "The Reader's Digest is not a magazine in the usual sense, but rather a cooperative means of rendering a time-saving service. Our association is serving you. It should also be serving your friends." There was indeed a Reader's Digest Association. DeWitt Wallace owned 52% of the stock. Lila Atchison Wallace owned 48%. Subscribers automatically became members, but were not encumbered with any ownership or control. The essence of the idea, DeWitt Wallace's basic discovery, as the official history of the magazine explains, was that this magazine would, by a mirror magic, actually express the reader himself. This is why it was called a Reader's Digest. Magazine articles could be written to please the reader, to give him the nub of the matter in a new fast-moving world of the 1920s, instead of being written at length and with literary embellishments to please the author or the editor. For about 10 years, the Digest followed Wallace's simple original procedure, searching other magazines for articles and stories to be adapted for its readers. Then, by the inexorable law of pseudo-events, the Reader's Digest began to spawn other pseudo-events. Wallace himself later described this innovation as an inevitable development, perhaps the most important in the Digest's history. Like all great inventions, the idea was beautifully simple. It was merely to plant a full-length article, prepared under Reader's Digest direction, in some other magazine, so it could afterwards be digested in the Reader's Digest. The editors of the Digest would conceive a 2-page piece for their own magazine. Instead of directly writing the 2-page article themselves, they would commission an author to prepare on this topic a full-length article, say 5 times the length of the predestined Digest abridgment. This proposed article, sometimes even before it was written, was then accepted by some other magazine, which would print it among its regular contents. The Digest paid for the whole process, including the full-length original. Here, of course, was a perfect example of a literary pseudo-event. The article was made to appear in the Saturday Evening Post, Ladies' Home Journal, Holiday, the American Legionnaire, or the Rotarian, primarily in order that it might afterwards be reported in the Digest. The motives behind this Reader's Digest innovation are not clear. Perhaps the energetic Wallace, now restless at remaining a dealer in second-hand articles, simply wanted to try manufacturing the original commodity. The magazine's official historian says it had become necessary. Many of the leading magazines, which had been fruitful sources of Digest material in the 1920s, the North American Review, Scribner's, The Century, Review of Reviews, Hearst's International, The Forum, World's Work, McClure's, The American, Collier's, Current History, Judge, The Old Life, The Delineator, Pictorial Review, Women's Home Companion, were now dead. Therefore, material which in condensed form would be suitable for the peculiar tone and character of the Reader's Digest was harder to find. The new digest formula required certain ideas in the originals which could not always be found in adequate supply. The very success of the digest had created a need which could be satisfied only by ensuring a steady flow of such articles, pseudo-articles if necessary, written for the purpose of being digested. Anyway, the difference between a pseudo-article and a spontaneous article would not appear in this skillfully digested product, just as the walls of Babylon on a movie set did not need to be solid so long as the photographed version made them look so. Whatever the motives, the effect was plain enough. The magazine, whose initial appeal was its ability to survey the scene, was now itself making the scene to be surveyed. Like the political interview or the tourist attraction, the planted article was produced in the honest effort to do a job, to give people what they paid for and what they expected. It was the determination of digest editors to be honest that actually accounted for the misrepresentation. The planted article, when it was digested in the Reader's Digest, could of course honestly be described as condensed from the American Legionnaire. Editors of the Digest for a while were understandably reticent about this development. The practice grew up only gradually. In the April 1930 Digest appeared the first article not attributed to any source publication. The article, Music and Work, was unsigned. Avoiding any damagingly clear admission of originality, it was labeled a special compilation for the Reader's Digest. 3 years later appeared the first signed original article, Insanity, the Modern Menace by Henry Morton Robinson. It was followed that year by a number of others, including The Burning Question, an article on cremation. At about the same time, there appeared in the Digest the first planted article. Sensitivity on this subject has made it hard to gather precise statistics. An independent study by George W. Bennett of the 5 years 1939 to 1943 inclusive discovered the facts on 1,718 or 90% of the 1,908 articles printed in the Digest during this period. Of these, 720 were digests on the original formula, reprinted abridgments of articles initiated by other periodicals. 316 were written expressly for the Digest and printed there alone. The remaining 682 were digests of planted articles. In other words, only a little over 40% of digest items in this period were really digests of what had spontaneously appeared elsewhere. Almost 60% were either confessed originals or disguised originals, fabricated by a contrived back formation from a contrived original. Later sampling suggests that about the same proportion continued into the following years. Most of what one read in the Reader's Digest, therefore, was not really a digest at all. In the age of the graphic revolution, people quite naturally prefer a shadow of a shadow to a shadow of an original. The uneasy editors of the most popular magazine of the 20th century, when they give readers gratis an attenuated piece of authentic literary originality, hardly dare confess it. Not until lately has the Reader's Digest openly defended its overshadowing of real abridgments by imitation abridgments. The practice, it is said, offers numerous advantages to the writer, the magazine which first publishes the material, and to the Digest. Where else but in 20th century America could editors have a guilty conscience and feel that somehow they might be cheating their readers when they offer something more original than it seems? 3. The Reader's Digest, while by far the most successful, was, of course, only one of a legion of digests. It produced a host of imitators and disciples. Scores of others sprang up quite independently. There was Writer's Digest, Catholic Digest, Protestant Digest, Omnibook, Science Digest, Negro Digest, Mystery Digest, Children's Digest, Compact, the Young People's Digest, Quick Digest, New Editions, a digest of bestsellers, and so on. Each commonly had a circulation larger than those of many of the magazines from which its materials were reprinted. Their existence, not to mention their spectacular success, witnessed the decline, even the dissolution, of literary form. When readers received, as the digest might boast, only the nub of the matter, instead of articles written at length and with literary embellishments to please the author or editors, they were receiving idea without form. A piece of printed matter was then believed to exist in a non-literary void. Then a story or article was indeed a nub or essence, for which words were only so much baggage. It was an emanation, a whiff of literary ectoplasm exuding from print, but not really residing in any set of words. The most popular reading matter now offered itself as substance without form. Literary embellishments, that is, anything, matter or form, which interested the author but might not interest some particular reader, seemed so much waste. They seemed merely to interfere with the reader. Magazine digests and abridgments, only one kind of many new dissolutions of form, were a byproduct of the multiplication and cheapening of printed matter. Between 1885 and 1905, the number of magazines being published at any one time in the United States, according to Frank Luther Mott's estimate, increased from 3,300 to 6,000. About 7,500 new magazines had been started. Seeing more magazines than anyone could possibly read, seeing a crowd of magazines almost indistinguishable from one another, the reader naturally needed help. He was glad to join an association to give him the nub of each of them. Not only in popular writing have we seen a dissolution of form and a search for the essence. The same dissolution has gone on in the world of science. It helps explain the modern divorce between scientist and humanist. The humanist has always been interested in the particular form, the literary embellishments, in which an idea is cast. He has considered language, rhetoric, vocabulary, and dramatic structure inseparable from idea. But the scientist, now more than ever, treats a scientific article or book as only a vehicle. He moves further and further away from the literary skills which made John James Audubon on ornithology, Charles Darwin on biology, and William James and Sigmund Freud on psychology become literary as well as scientific classics. This is due not only to the fast pace of advance in 20th century science, but also to the sheer multiplication, since the graphic revolution, of the printed matter in which these advances are diffused. Between 1940 and 1960, the number of scientific and technical articles published each year increased twofold or threefold. In 1960 alone, the number of these articles appearing in the 60-odd major languages of the world was between 1 and 2 million. These were published in between 50,000 and 100,000 technical journals. To collect and digest the information on any subject has therefore become a vast and complex new problem. To help solve it, an IBM inventor, H. Peter Lunn, has developed a computer program for auto-abstracting. A machine automatically makes a statistical analysis of all the significant words in an article. It is designed to omit the trivial words, the ifs, ands, and buts. Having calculated the 10 or 20 most frequent words, the machine then picks out sentences with the highest density of these keywords. An automatic compilation of these sentences becomes the auto-abstract of the article. The pressing need for such a machine comes from the fact that even the abstracts of scientific articles have become so numerous that no scientist can keep up with them. By the middle of the 20th century, there were about 300 journals devoted exclusively to summarizing articles appearing in other journals. If we do not find some way of abstracting the abstracts, observes Derek J. DeSola Price in his brilliant Science Since Babylon, 1961, It may well happen that the printed research paper will be doomed, though it will be difficult to rid ourselves of the obsession that it seems vital to science. What Thomas J. Watson, Jr., president of International Business Machines Corporation, calls the information explosion is having an ever wider and deeper effect on the form in which we are willing to have our ideas expressed. And incidentally, it cannot fail to affect the respect we show for a literary or any other kind of form. Translation, until recently, has been among the subtlest, most difficult, and most respected of literary arts. Many literary figures, like Chapman, North, Dryden, and Longfellow, earned laurels by translations of Homer, Plutarch, and Dante. Others, like Fitzgerald and Scott Moncrief, attained literary fame primarily through their translations. Much of the intellectual finesse which came from a traditional classical education, in England, for example, came from the exercise of translation into and out of Greek, Latin, and English. The decline of the classics and of foreign language study generally in America has gradually deprived us of this discipline. Now, in order to make available the increasing printed resources in other languages, the new data processing industry has perfected a machine translator. The Mark II machine, developed jointly by IBM and the Air Force, can take a passage of Russian and translate it into what IBM calls rough but meaningful English. Here is a sample product of the machine when applied to a passage of Russian literary criticism. United States appeared new translation immortal novel L. N. Tostago, War and World, Peace. Truth, not all novel, but only several fragments out of it, even so few little that they occupy all one typewritten page. But nonetheless this achievement. Nevertheless, culture not stands, costs on place. Something translate. Something print. Truth by opinion certain literature skeptics, translation made enough, fairly oak. But this, as they say, opinion separate malignant. If, however, who doubt in qualification translator, that admirer, it, its talent can tell, disclose, that it possess store words, equal 600,000s, at the time when Shakespeare had to satisfy all only some pitiful 24,000 words. Inflamed discussion literature specialists, representative American unification translators, obviously out of competition, consideration, attempted defame new celebrity, indicated in particular on that certain specific Russian expression translated too much literally, without transmission them their true meaning. On the other hand, engineer assured that this shortage will soon after removed and on light world will be able to appear even written in verse translation. With scientific research moving ahead so speedily, scientists dare not wait even the 2 or 3 months usually required to secure publication in a technical journal. They cannot wait to secure reprints like those which social scientists and humanists circulate among their colleagues. Instead, by a kind of scientific analog to the Reader's Digest abridgment of the planted article, they now use the device of the preprint. This is a version of an article made available before its publication. The most important scientific research institutions are coming to be what Derek J. DeSola Price calls the new invisible colleges. The regular informal meetings of the most advanced scientists where they exchange their latest findings. In the great centers of research, impatient, energetic scientists will not wait till their fellows elsewhere put results in printed form. They commonly use the long-distance telephone to be sure they have not neglected what their enterprising collaborators elsewhere may have discovered only this morning.